I'm going to talk now. So Les had asked me to do a question and answer session about state of things. The other thing that I had done was just to break things up a little bit I'd also decided to bring in a lecture from Suzuki Roshi, that if you guys want to go through that, instead of doing a question answer session, we can do that, or we can do a question answer session. How many people would like to listen, would like to go through the Suzuki Roshi lecture, or would like to do a question answer? No hands? Now, I'm just saying that either we can do the Suzuki Roshi lecture or we can. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, and so it's 50-50 almost. Okay, that's going to be interesting. Okay, so let's do it. Okay, that's what I was thinking was going to happen anyways. So... okay, so let me do this. I'll start with this whole idea was born out of this, especially this night, was born out of when I was listening to Ed Brown talk at Tassahara, and I would just felt like he had been practicing for, I think now it's been 40 years, and he had a lot of anger. I could just feel his anger emanating. And he had gone to Suzuki Roshi and actually talked to him about this and said, he said, I get angry. And he said to him, yes, you can get angry, but don't. So, and I was talking to Les about this and I said, it just seems to me that there is a lot of this that goes around in all of our lives, that, you know, we have so many things and we have everything that is available to us and to everybody else, yet there's a sense of dissatisfaction that stays with all of us. And this sense of dissatisfaction was the reason why I was talking to Les about it, and I said, why didn't you talk to people about this? And then this is why I'm sitting up here today and talking to you about this. So, I started out by looking at this chapter where Suzuki Roshi talks about everyday life is like a movie. So, I'll read a part of the... I won't read the whole thing. I'll read a part of it. He says, as Zen students, our life begins with Zazen practice. We come back to zero and start from zero. Although we have various activities, the most important thing is to realize how these activities arise from zero. At the moment you decide to sit, it means you have already set your alarm. When you have enough confidence to make the decision to start practicing Zazen, that is zero. During Zazen, you may hear a bird singing, something is arising in your practice. In the same way, in our everyday life, many things will arise. And if you know where these signs arise from, you will not be disturbed by them. Because you don't know how it happens, you become confused. If you know how things arise, then at that moment, something happens and you will be ready. Oh, something is arising. It is like watching the sunrise. Oh, look, the sun is just coming up. For instance, sometimes you will get angry, but anger actually doesn't come all of a sudden. It may come slowly. When you feel anger comes all of a sudden, that is real anger. But when you know how it comes, anger is arising in my mind, that is not anger. People may say that you are angry, but you are actually not angry. if you know you are about to start crying, oh, I'm going to cry, and then in the next 2 or 3 minutes, oh, I've started crying. That is not crying. Our practice is to accept things as you accept various images in your sitting. The most important thing is to have a big mind and accept things. If you practice Zazen to obtain enlightenment, it will be like using the alarm clock without setting the time. It will go off anyway, but it doesn't make much sense. To sit every morning at a certain time makes sense. To know what you are doing at a particular time is the most important thing. This is to make the effort according to the situation that you are in. This was the most important two paragraphs for me out of this chapter, because he actually talks about anger. And I wanted to bring up this whole idea of anger, that anger comes up and there's a sense of dissatisfaction that comes up. 2 weeks ago when we were at Tassahara, they made me, they gave me the duty to clean the rooms, and it was just very difficult. It was just like, internally it was very difficult to go and clean somebody else's room. And it was a sense of resistance that kept on coming up. And it was just resistance, resistance, resistance. And I was like, okay. And then I saw, then we had a break and I saw Les. And I remember what Les had told me once. He said, if resistance comes up, embrace it. Whatever comes up, embrace it. So I just embraced it and went along with it. But it didn't make me angry, but it was very dissatisfying to take care of somebody else's area. And that's why I wanted to bring this up. Has anybody else had this kind of feeling? Am I the only one? What comes up for people? Yes,
So I think that there are probably different trigger factors for different people, you know, what makes them angry. And I think Zazen kind of helps you realize what those things are, you know, helps you kind of process. And for me in particular, it's the feeling of loss of control. I'm kind of a type A control freak, and if the situation is something I can't control, I get angry. And I mean, I think Zazen is just a way to help me realize that, you know, in reality, you're not really in control and you need to let go. And so that's one way I deal with letting go of my anger.
So this need that we all have to control, where do you think that comes from?
I think partly, at least for me, partly it's, I feel like it's part of my personality. I mean, I do think that different people have different inherent personalities. Some people, you know, are more easygoing, others are, you know, more... things have to go a certain way for me to feel comfortable in the situation. And I think, at least for me, I think a lot of it comes from my family upbringing. So I feel like
yes, Mark.
So this this Suzuki Roshi lecture is a real moment. and I've read it many, many times. And I think what he's, one interpretation of this lecture is the movie that's on the screen is our ego. And he's saying that the true reality of things, whether or not you clean your room or somebody else's room or not, it's the same thing. It's the same action, but it's your ego, your interpretation, what it is you need to do, that determines how you feel about it. And just like the movie on the screen, you know it's not real. It's just an image on the screen. You interpret your ego as being the ultimate reality of things, and you filter things through your ego, and that's what causes you to become upset when you feel like something is beneath you, or you feel like you're not being treated fairly, or effectively, or whatnot. And for me, the whole point of, or one of the big points is in practice, is when I get pissed about something, and something makes me mad, I try to look into my ego. I try to look through the screen, you know, the movie, to see the real screen, and understand why it is these things make me mad, why things affect me in the way that they do. And usually it's some disconnect between my ego and the way things really are. And once you reconcile that, it doesn't make you mad anymore.
So what you're saying is there's a lack of acceptance, and when you get to that point where you accept things as they are, things become, life becomes a little bit easier to deal with?
I think there's a lack of understanding. You know, you don't, it's like one of those feelings where something makes you mad and you're not sure why.
Mm-hmm.
It's because you don't really understand yourself well enough yet, or that part of yourself well enough. And something can really make you angry and you're not quite sure what it is. And then that anger kind of bleeds over into other areas of your life. And then you just feel kind of irritated, right? But I think that for me, backing up and using my Zen practice to create kind of a mind of equanimity. I mean, that's what the screen is, right? The screen is calmness in a bad situation. So that you can see your ego versus what really is. You can separate the two and you can understand yourself a little better.
Thank you. Leslie.
For me, I have examined my anger, you know, over many years, especially in meditation. And I think it arises from a sense of pain. That first, what I feel is a sadness, perhaps in some way that I feel I've been treated in the past, or disrespected, or just something that really hurts. And then the anger comes up. So I think it's a sign when somebody is always angry. I think that it's a sign that there's some pain underneath it. They're feeling some maybe pain at injustice or some past treatment or that's what it really arises from for some people. And I think that I'm one of them. If I get angry, it's because I feel, you know, that it will somehow resonate with some old pain. So I don't know if that works for anybody else. Thank you.
Yes.
The idea of a loss of control makes an awful lot of sense to me. And one of the most subtle places that I see that, the obvious places aren't that useful because it's like, the whole thing was done, or that was a terrible childhood wound, so obviously I'm angry. The more subtle places are interesting to me because they're like, you know, that really got me angry, really? So I notice that if I'm feeling particularly in my own space and somebody invades my space, like, you know, maybe just even on an elevator, they just step too close. That's a pretty subtle, like, wow, I got angry over that. And that is, like, well, I was controlled in that space. And so now I got to share the control of that space. It also doesn't surprise me. The image that's coming to me is something in sort of science that's getting real popular, is this idea that these streams of things we take in as our stimuli only start making sense to us as babies when we can verify, oh, that's, you know, that's mom coming, and then we kind of test it, and then it turns out that it is. So our actions are actually a great sense of security that we actually have a handle on the world or some control. Yeah, I get that result when I do that. So when we don't have that control, I can see where that might be disorienting to people in kind of maybe a silly way, but also kind of have some compassion for that too.
Yeah, like Morgan was saying, that he goes on to talk about the screen, and the screen itself is, in the end, he actually, I mean, the synopsis of the whole chapter was, when you are practicing, you realize your mind is like a screen. It's like a screen. If the screen is colorful enough to attract people, then it will not serve its purpose. So you have a screen which is not colorful. To have a pure white screen is the most important point. And to further what you were saying was that you said that somebody has invaded your space. I did lots of research and some time off, so I was actually sitting there and doing research on anger. And one of the things that I found, two things that I found, were that the generalized point of view was anger is when somebody has crossed a line with you or disrespected you. And then one day I was sitting inside this end over here, and I was actually sitting there, and we were talking with Les and asking Les questions. And I asked Les, I said, raised my hands up and said, Les, what is sitting underneath anger? And he took his usual pause and said, fear. And it was just interesting, because when he said that, it was like he just hated right where it was. It was just like, okay, this is where your real point is, you know, that you're afraid of something, and this is where anger comes from. And that was a real opening for me. And so, as I was saying earlier on, that it is something that we all feel and we go through, and it can sometimes be very difficult. Another passage from this, I'm just going to read this and then we can move on from this, is you enjoy something that makes you angry or makes you cry, and you enjoy the crying and the anger too. If you have no idea of the screen, then you will be afraid of enlightenment. What is it? Oh my. If someone attains enlightenment, you may ask him about the experience that he had. When you hear about the experience, you may say, oh no, that's not for me. But it is just a movie, you know, something for you to enjoy. If you want to enjoy the movie, you should know that it is a combination of film and light and the screen. And the most important thing is the plain white screen. So he keeps on coming back to this, which is a plain white screen. And I was reading the rest of the book too, and then other places where he talks about stuff like, he'll say, we practice Zazen, and what is actually true activity? We practice Zazen, and what is true activity? Intuitive activity, free from various desires and restrictions. It is difficult to figure out what is good practice. If you stick to your greed or your anger or some other emotion or thinking mind or monkey mind, you cannot change. Your mind is not soft. Give up your small mind. And this is from another part of the book, from one of the other chapters. I just taken this out. It was really interesting when he was talking about this. I was thinking, huh, this is the problem that most of us have. I mean, it still comes up. My mind will, I think it's been like 11 years now, sitting, and my mind still runs away. sometimes. And this is something that comes up, and then I have to say to myself, what am I doing? I have to come back to my breath. So I keep on coming back to my breath. And it was interesting, when I was thinking about this, I was like thinking, this is really, really interesting what Suzuki Roshi is talking about. You know, anger caught my attention then, you know, this whole idea of intuitive activity caught my attention, and after coming back from Tassahara, when did we come back on last, it was two Sundays ago?
It was Friday.
Ten days ago. I was watching an interview with John Mellencamp, the singer, and he's interesting. He actually said that in 1988, I decided to give up being that guy who I did not like. He said, I was the guy who was constantly saying, oh, where is my album? Is it on the number one chart? Is it, you know, is my song doing well? Am I doing well? As he said, I didn't want to be that guy anymore. I gave up being that guy in 1988. And he said, what happened to me was I decided to become an artist. And as an artist, I just paint and I write and I paint and I write and I do this in isolation. And he said, the strange thing about isolation is that the muse speaks to you. And after hearing that, I went back to reading this and I was thinking, Zazen is like that too. It's like, it's a very intuitive activity. It just has no distractions. You're just constantly, you're completely in one sort of line with everything that you're doing, whether you're painting, you're writing, you're doing anything. You're in one line with that. And it gives you this sort of energy and this, it opens up something in you that you can, you know, put out to the world or put it down on a piece of paper or paint or do something like that where it becomes an expression of that feeling that you have. And to me that was really interesting how those two things came together and connected, and it was just like, wow, this is amazing. And that, you know, I was reading this, and even when we were at Tassahara, Les made us do haikus, and we were all writing haikus, and it was just, for 3 days we sat there and we wrote haikus, and it was just, I think it was one of the most difficult things that I've ever done, is to just let go and just put down on paper whatever was coming out. But it came out of intuition. It was that quiet place. It was that place that, you know, there were no desires. There were no restrictions. It was just this place where everything was just flowing by itself. First time it was hard. Second time it got easier. Third time it was just like I just put the pen to the paper and just started writing things down. They were just flowing. It was just flowing. And I was thinking, this is just amazing how this can happen with, we don't sort of realize this kind of intuition is there, that we all have this, and it's amazing to get in touch with something like that. Yes, sir.
Like a little bit of a summary of something said, is that at least from my experience, Zazen, probably what has provided is to try to diminish the small man and to try to think in a bigger man. Almost in everything ends up in that. So listening, for example, is interesting. We say no self. We try to become the self. But when we say, I need control, probably in a scale, in something small. Someone getting my space. All that is very self, is very, very small self. So, and I get angry sometimes, very angry, and sometimes an important thing, and I think that human beings, like, they will be like a normal thing, can you embrace it and deal with it? But what about when they're not important things, when they're small things? So one thing that I have tried to do is that when I see the sun coming up, or when it's up, is to jump into large unit. And the way to do that is, for example, to say, oh, I can argue when I'm in control, probably something small. Well, like a sister-in-law that died of cancer at 46 because she couldn't control the growth of a tumor. That's out of control. Or, for example, you say, my space matters. Well, you see a picture of the refugees in the Mediterranean where babies jump into the water, and probably the thing they wanted most was to invade from space. So that space is developed. But in many of the things, when we get angry, is because it's me, and it's enough just to think about something else. You say, for example, when I was listening to you, oh, I didn't like dealing with the rooms of everyone. Well, why do you think about a maid in a poor country that makes no money for spending her whole life living in a room? And oh, you think that and you're under limited. So for me to make some kind of trip to go from small mind to big mind, helping these things. Maybe humble.
Yes, sir.
I think that for me, and I think for many people, even if you get to the point where you understand your anger and you are in that space of equanimity, the hardest thing is when other people are angry. So, say, you're driving, or you're in a grocery store, or whatever situation, you're interacting with colleagues, and they've just lost it. Now, to be in a space which you normally are in can go away very quickly. And then your tricks. Now is the biggest trick. Well, what are you going to pull out of the bag? You have a person in front of you who is not in a good space. There are no clouds around to look at and to bring you back. Because that's my trick. Is look at the clouds. Beautiful. It's very difficult to be in front of somebody who is angry and to really be in a big mind. To me, that's one of the hardest challenges. I mean, walking into a room is hard, cleaning up other people's toilets is hard, sure, but you can get over that. But when you're in front of somebody who is really angry, and to raise yourself into a big mind, that's so challenging. I don't have any quick answers for that. So I'll leave that to Omar.
Yeah, anger has always been a big one for me, and that's why I find, Les had said that anger has a fear underneath it. I always thought that it comes from the sense of dissatisfaction with the moment, that you're not happy with this moment. Till one day, I think I was sitting down and I was just, nothing was going right. Everything that could go wrong went wrong. Lost my wallet, was late for work, couldn't find the keys, I thought I lost the keys in the car, and it was just one thing after another, and started getting angry and angry and angry, and to a point where this voice came out of me that said, I said out loud, this is not good enough. And this voice came out of me that said, when will it be good enough? And it was like, almost I was standing there going, who said that? Was it, what? I mean, it's like, seriously? I was very confused. I was like, instead of being getting angry, I just got confused. I was like, what? Who said that? Which moment is going to be enough for you? When is it going to be enough? And it was just like, so I sat down for like 2 minutes and then took a few deep breaths and I said, okay, what do I do now? And I said, okay, let's retrace my steps. And I went ahead and found my wallet. It was exactly sitting where I had left it. Since the wallet was brown and I placed it on a piece of wood that was brown, I didn't see it. And I found my keys in the other pocket, which they weren't supposed to be in, and they were. But it was interesting that out of that little incident came this whole idea that this is not good enough. And this whole thing that I was telling you about even with cleaning people's rooms, it was just, underneath it was this feeling that this is not good enough. There should be something better for me to do. And it was just feeling that was there, and it was just like, but I stayed with it. Because it's, so, I mean, after going and seeing Les was standing there and drinking water, and I saw him standing there, and I was thinking of going and talking to him, but I didn't talk to him. I said, no, wait, what would he say? Let's say, embrace it. So I embraced it and went back to work. I was like, okay, this is how you do it. So took care of it. But it's hard. It's hard. Even when Ed Brown was talking, I was just thinking about the same thing. I was like going, you know, it's like he has this anger, and I opened this book up and found out that it was actually translated by Edward Brown, which was also an interesting thing. One of the things that I want to read was this piece from the same book, Not Always So. So we put our emphasis on warm feeling we have in our practice. In other words, enlightenment or Buddha's mercy or Buddha mind. It is not a matter of just counting your breath or following your breath, but the point is inhaling and exhaling to take care of the breath. Just as a mother watches her baby. If a baby smiles, its mother will smile. If a baby cries, its mother is worried. That is the kind of close relationship being one with your practice is the point. I'm not talking about anything new, same old things. Our monastic rules are based on kind, warm-hearted mind. The idea is not to restrict your freedom, but rather to give you freedom to behave and act in your own way. It is not important to follow the rules liberally, literally. Actually, if you break a rule now and then, we will know what is wrong with you, and your teacher, without criticizing you, may be able to help you more accurately. This is how to improve your practice in order to have a good control over your desires and your everyday life. Then you will have big freedom from everything. That is the goal of our practice for both priests and for lay people. please take care of your practice. And be very kind with yourself. It's interesting to me that as a Sangha we take care of each other, but it begins with, according to Suzuki Roshi over here, is with taking care of your breath. So you take care of your breath, and from there onwards you take care of yourself and you take care of other people. I think that's important. And our lives have become so bizarrely...
So what's that?
Our lives have become so bizarrely busy that I was in Fremont today and I was getting some tires changed. And I left the car and I said, okay, you guys can swap out my tires. I'm going to go and grab a bite to eat. I walked down to a place to eat and came back, and I realized something. On the road, they had put down signs that say, look. And there was an arrow pointing that way, and the two O's in the letter look had a little eyeballs in it going sort of that way. It was really interesting, and I was like, this is really interesting. And the street sign, the crossing, excuse me, the button that you press to cross the road actually now talks to you and says, please wait so and so much time, the cars are going, please wait. It keeps on telling you that. Well, this is interesting. And this is not only happening here in our country, in our culture, but it's happening everywhere. I was watching a show on DWTV last night, and they were talking about people looking down while they're walking and crossing the road. They're looking into their devices. And it was so interesting that they had actually, they're coming up with these new ingenious ideas that that part of the sidewalk that you approach before you cross the road actually lights up. It goes into different colors. It goes to like red and it goes to green. And it's like, it's almost like, hey, people have a signal now as to if they can cross the road or not. I was like, this is interesting. But the strange thing was, I saw a few people walk by me and they were looking down and doing this, and they stopped and looked down and they said, oh, okay, look. And they stopped and looked. So it was working. But the weirdest thing was, these two women were walking by and both of them could not, both of them were deaf and mute, and they were talking to each other with hand signs. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. Here we are in this world, people who can talk and can listen and who can hear, and they are not engaged. I saw two people walking together, and they're not talking to each other. Both of them were doing this. And these people, these two, were looking at each other. They were communicating with each other. They were having this conversation with sign language. I was going, this is amazing. This is phenomenally amazing. This is like their, and they were very aware of their own environment and the situation that they were in. I was like, and we forget that we're in this situation. I was on the sidewalk and I was walking down the sidewalk. These two guys were in a car and they came by and they were on their phone texting while they're driving. They didn't even see me when I'm there. So I had to like wait for them so they leave and then I can cross the street. It's amazing how much of what Suzuki Roshi is talking about is relevant to here. It's like, you know, it's about taking care of your own breath. People forget about taking care of their breath. People forget about taking care of each other. People forget about looking around and seeing what's around them. And the strange thing was these two people who did not have the senses to talk or to hear were more engaged than we ever will be. That was amazing to me. And they were actually taking care of each other while they were crossing the street. They were looking around and they were crossing the street. I was like, wow, this is amazing. When you don't have things, you become more aware, and when you have things, you become more sort of, you end up getting lost in things. There's less and less of that awareness. It just goes away. It's like I was in walking down, where the redwood trees are. Near Green Gulch, what's it called?
Near Woods.
Near Woods, yeah, thank you. And people were complaining that they weren't getting a phone signal. And that was the most funniest thing. And I looked at Lee and I said, no. And I looked at Lee and quietly said, I said, good that they're not getting a phone signal. Something is forcing them to pay attention and see where they're going, because all the paths are so narrow, nobody's seeing where they're going. They wanted to do this on their walk. And it was just amazing to hear that. But when that happens, it's awareness just comes up. It's just your basic awareness just goes like this. And I was thinking, this is amazing how, you know, it's so easy to lose awareness and that's your basic taking care of yourself. And people forget that. And it's just reminding people of basic things is just very tough. It can be very tough. It's like, I used to see that at Stanford all the time when I worked at Stanford, that I remember this girl was riding her bicycle, and with her, she had her phone in her hand. She's doing this and doing this, and she goes straight into one of the poles, and her phone goes that way, she goes that way, her bike goes that way. I'm going, okay, and this other girl saw her who wasn't texting. She ran over to her and said, are you okay? Are you okay? And she picked her up, brushed her off. And I was like going, this is what happens. And that was the scary thing. I was like thinking, how are these people going to function in the real world when they have to go out? But I think the real world is just becoming more and more like that world. So, any questions, any comments? Yes, Martha.
Thank you, Umar. It was very nice of you to handle this. And I think part of, I don't know if you chose that chapter because of anger is kind of what's going on now. If we were to have a discussion, a lot of it would be about the politics and the anger that's kind of dominates any conversations. So it was very apropos, and I liked your observation also about the people that are sensory deprived are much more here now than people with iPhones. And a blind person must be even more so attuned to what's going on around him. Very good observations. Thank you for your talk.
Thank you. When you were saying, when you're talking about anger, you mean what's going on in the world right now?
Yeah. And it's just a lot of friction. Turn any direction. Something going on.
That's an interesting word, friction. I was reading about that the other day, and somebody said that friction is really what happens to you internally and what is happening outside, and when those two things don't go together, that's what causes friction. And I was thinking, this is an interesting point of view to take, that this kind of thinking can actually take place. Yeah. It is very difficult right now for everyone, I think, with what has happened in Texas, what is happening with people with certain status and with the incoming, I think, hurricane that's coming in towards Florida. It's definitely living in a very difficult times. I think that's what it is. And difficulty is never easy to handle. It just gets harder and harder. And I think that's why we have this practice, that we have to start from, as Suzuki Roshi was saying, that we have to start from zero. And we have to go back to zero and start from zero again. When something like that happens, it's like you have to do something. You have to take care of things, you have to do something, otherwise it just gets out of hand. Think we're good? Okay, thank you everyone.